Hello, my friends. Welcome to Influencers Cafe. Thank you for joining us on another episode of exploration in knowledge and various other things like that. Today on the show, we have an expert biologist, virologist, Anjanette Roberts.
Hello, good to be here.
Nice to have you on the show today.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about it. Looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks for coming on in what must be a very busy time, considering the panic around the world with this coronavirus right now.
Yeah, I'd like to think that we are cautiously concerned rather than panicked. So let's go with that. They're pesky little things and they're all around us, but most of them aren't doing us any harm. They're actually doing us quite a lot of good. Most of them are infecting bacteria and giving us a nice, healthy place to live on planet Earth. But every once in a while, we'll get a rogue one that sets us on our heels and sometimes even worse. Yeah.
So is the viruses only attack bacteria?
Oh, they attack all living cells. So anything that's alive can be attacked by a virus. So bacteria are alive. So there's a whole class of viruses called bacteriophage, or phage for short, and those attack bacteria. But there's thousands of different kinds of viruses that affect all kinds of different living organisms. Viruses need living cells in order to make more viruses, so they can't reproduce on their own. So they have to have some kind of an affinity for a cell, and then when they find their way into that cell makes more viruses, and so goes the cycle of life.
So let me just try and go back on some of my education. So viruses, they inject DNA, which goes into the soma of a cell, and the ribosomes in the cell will then transcribe it into proteins. Is that what happens?
Well, you got bits and pieces of it, right? So again, viruses are incredibly diverse. Some of them are DNA viruses. And the DNA viruses, so they carry their own genomes. Viruses all carry their own genomes. So the genomes can be either DNA or RNA. And in the case of the coronavirus that's circulating in China right now, that genome is actually a positive sense RNA, which means it can actually serve as messenger RNA. And messenger RNA is what the ribosomes used to make proteins.
Right,
so
yeah.
In the normal course of molecular biological function, you have DNA that's transcribed into RNA, RNA that's then translated into proteins. So yeah, you were bits and pieces right there.
Oh,
good job.
I'm embarrassed because I've got mRNA and DNA messed up there. That's my professor's not going to be happy. But
no, that's okay. I mean, you weren't cheating. You weren't looking at any notes. So close enough for now.
So for people that haven't done high school biology, the cells are basically comprised of the outer cell and then the inner cell, which contains the DNA, and it's called the nucleus. And DNA gets transcribed from the nucleus into mRNA, and that then goes into the soma, or the sort of outer part of the cell, or this the bit of the soma of the cell, the bit of the cell between the edge of the cell and the nucleus. And these other devices turn it into proteins.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. We sometimes call the soma the cytoplasm.
So
So there you go. Good job.
So this coronavirus, it injects mRNA into the cell, and then the ribosomes transcribe it into one single protein or like multiple proteins.
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, it gets kind of a little bit more complex than that. But the coronavirus can either enter at the cell membrane, or most likely it's being taken up into vesicles called endosomes. And then the endosome undergoes a pH change, and then the virus is basically released into the cytoplasm. And the viral RNA then serves as a template for an enzyme that's incorporated in the virus particle that's released into the cell when the infection takes place. And so that enzyme basically copies the viral RNA into complementary subgenomic strands of RNA, and then those subgenomic strands of RNA serve as template for the same enzyme to make messenger RNA, and then those messenger RNAs get translated into a variety of proteins. So the coronavirus, the one that I studied was the first sort of major outbreak of a coronavirus that was associated with human fatality. That was called SARS coronavirus, and that hit in 2003. And for that virus, we know quite a lot because we've had several years to study it. That virus encodes at least 13 genes that make 14 proteins, 14 different proteins. So we think it's probably a similar structure and genetic makeup to the virus that's circulating now in China. So a very large RNA genome, the largest RNA genome known in viruses, almost 30,000 base pairs. So that's pretty big.
So for those that haven't done biology, a base pair is...
Actually, 30,000 bases is what I should say, because it's not paired, it's not double-stranded DNA, it's single-stranded RNA. So 30,000 bases, that was my mistake.
So the bases is like the digital code for...
Yeah, that's the ACGT, yes. Yeah.
So in DNA, it's not binary, it's one over four combinations per item. So it's like the digital is like 1010 with biology, it's T, A, and C, G.
Yes.
Those
bases then are read in codons, and codons are basically the equivalent of three bases in a row. So when it's transcribed into RNA, the RNA then is translated into proteins, and the translation protein is based on three bases in the RNA at a time. That's called a codon. And so three different bases encode for different amino acids in a protein sequence.
Okay.
You remember that bit? Yep.
Yeah, maybe. It's coming back to me. It's been like okay. these exams that I've done, like I've been a software developer for 12 years now or something, and the biophysics.
I think because you're a software developer, I think you care more about these little intricacies to these details we're talking about. I'm not sure how many people that are listening in will care quite as much as we do, but keep hacking away at it.
For me as a software developer, the nucleus is like, it's just like a computer that's executing instructions, and the ribosomes and that are basically the central processing unit that's taking in the data and outputting instructions.
Yeah. So it's weird. I guess it's like the virus, like the coronavirus, brings along its own little sort of accessory hardware unit, right? In that it brings along its own enzyme that tinkers with its genome to put it into a different form that it then tinkers with again, and then the product out of that second tinkering is what's presented to the cell's ribosomes.
So when we say that the coronavirus encodes something like 14 proteins, these are the proteins that make up the bacteriophage?
Well, so yeah, bacteriophage is a completely different kind of virus. Those are the viruses that infect bacteria. We're talking about a coronavirus right now that infects humans. So the coronaviruses are known to infect animals, including things like mice and cattle. But there are five that are well known amongst virologists that infect human beings. And two of them we've known about for a very long time, since the 1960s at least. And both of those are just associated with the common cold. But in 2003, there was an outbreak with SARS coronavirus, which also happened in China, Guangdong Province, China. And then in 2012, there was another coronavirus that's now called MERS, which stands for Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, because it was detected first in Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. And now there's this third one in China also in Wuhan City, and it's being referred to as COVID-19 for coronavirus 2019. So anyway, that's a little bit of history of coronaviruses, but coronaviruses infect animals, including humans, and they usually infect the respiratory tract, the upper and lower respiratory tract, and sometimes also the gastrointestinal tract. And so you can end up with both coughing and upset stomach, diarrhea, the whole bit. So
yeah,
more information than my software programmer probably wanted.
No, that's good to see.
No, we can go good. In. Okay. Yeah.
I read about the process of the the physiological effects of this virus, and it seems like it's really nasty. It's like almost like drowning in slow motion.
Yeah, well, it's because this and other respiratory viruses, including like influenza, it can lead to either viral pneumonia or atypical pneumonia, or sometimes secondary infections can come in, bacteria can come in and cause a pneumonia. But yeah, the most severe cases are associated with pneumonia, and pneumonia kills a lot of people. Flu kills a lot of people every year because of pneumonia. In the case of SARS, again, I'm going to keep referring to SARS because we know much more about it biologically than we do about the one that's currently circulating, because those studies haven't been done yet on the one that's currently circulating, that's just emerged. But in the case of SARS, we know that part of the disease process is when you get infected, your immune system sort of goes into overdrive to try and clear the infection. But part of what happens when SARS infects lung tissue is that the immune system responds, and the immune system cells that respond first release cytokines. It's like a chemical signal to other cells to come and help. And what happens is what's referred to as a cytokine storm in the case of SARS. And so basically the immune system goes kind of on overdrive, and it's actually this cytokine storm that leads to a lot of the pathology, a lot of the cellular destruction. And so it's actually sort of an imbalanced or immune response in overdrive that leads to fatalities in people who are of advanced age or have comorbidities. They already have disease like heart disease or lung disease or kidney disease. These add confounding factors, and it's those things in conjunction that lead to the fatalities. And so for the most part, coronaviruses, even SARS and even the one that's infecting people now, don't have a very high rate of fatality. SARS, by the time it was over, and it only lasted about 1 year, it had a fatality rate of about 10% unless you were over the age of 50. If you were over the age of 50 or you had comorbidities, that was about 50% mortality. So far in the one that's circulating now in China and spreading to other areas of the world, we're still in the early phases of the outbreak, so we don't know exactly what the mortality rate will be. But right now, the current mortality rate is less than 3%. But it's still higher if you're older, and it's still higher if you have comorbidities. Now, I don't want to make it sound like coronaviruses are all hunky-dory, because MERS, the one that I left out, that the outbreak began in 2012, that has a fatality rate of 35%. So that's pretty significant.
Crazy.
That's significant, yeah.
That's like smallpox almost, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't recall the fatality rate for smallpox, so don't put me in a box on that one. I don't know.
I read something that was like 50% or something crazy.
Yeah. But you know, again, there's 35%. Sort of balancing news that shouldn't lead to panic, and that's this. You know, SARS spread fairly easily from person to person. By the time the outbreak was over, I think around over 8,000 people were infected, but less than 9,000. In the case of MERS, which has been going on since 2012, so the outbreak occurred in 2012, but there are still cases of MERS today entering the human population. The numbers of people infected with MERS, although it has a higher fatality rate, aren't as high. And so even since 2012, there's only been 2,500 infections total since 2012 for MERS.
Is that because the infection rate is less than one?
We don't know what the infection rate is. We don't know how many people were exposed to it. But, you know, MERS has been going, let's say, from 2012 to 2020. It's infected 2,500 people. It has a fatality rate of about 35%. And so it still happens. And what it suggests by those numbers is that when it enters the human population, it doesn't do a good job of spreading human to human. But the humans that get it, they get pretty sick, and 1 in 3 die. And so with SARS, it spread fairly well because it only lasted a year, and yet it spread to over 8,000 people, but it didn't kill very many. Now, this one is spreading like, in comparison to those two, this one's spreading like wildfire, right? The most recent data is that over 71,000 people are infected. That's a lot.
Yeah.
But the fatality rate is really, really low compared to SARS and MERS. So, at least so far it is.
So what is particularly scary is that, you know, in terms of like accidents, like road accidents, things like that, it's often many small things that happen together at the same time that can cause a bigger accident. So one person's not paying attention, they're going too fast, yep. There's timing of the lights, or you get all this sort of combination. And you get the accident with these viruses. If just one of those parameters was tweaked, say, for the coronavirus, if the mortality rate was the same as SARS, then we'd have a dreadful, dreadful situation right now.
If it was the same as MERS, we would have a dreadful situation. If one in three were dropping dead, you'd have over 20,000 deaths, approaching 25,000 deaths already. So, that would be very scary. Fortunately, that's not the scenario currently. So this one seems to spread, perhaps it spreads more easily human to human. But there's a lot we still don't know about this virus. We don't know where it came from. We don't know how it entered the human population. The speculation is that it probably, the initial cases were sort of linked back to a seafood market in or near Wuhan City. But they haven't identified an animal reservoir. And so in the case of SARS, we did. We identified a primary animal reservoir. It was known as civet, or a civet cat. And it's basically a weasel-like animal. Mm. And the civets don't harbor the virus in nature. It's not where the virus hangs out. But civets can be infected. They probably get it from bats, or contact with bat dung or something to that extent, or bat secretions. And then the civets were captured and sold in animal markets in China, and some of those infected civets came in contact with humans, and the virus made the jump from the civet to the humans in the case of SARS. In the case of MERS, the one that has the high fatality rate, again, we think that the animal reservoir is likely, get this, a dromedary camel. And so people are probably getting it from camels. But again, it doesn't hang out in the camels in nature. The camels are probably getting it from bats or some other intermediate host. So in the case of the one that's circulating now, that's infecting a lot of people, we don't know where it's being introduced into the human population. We don't know how that's happening. And so it could be something that hasn't been identified yet. And those transmissions from the infected animal to the human population can be an ongoing event, especially in China. But those cases that are leaving China are obviously human-to-human spread. They go to different countries, people come in contact with people who've gotten the virus in China, and they spread it back in their home countries, or on cruise ships, like it's happening on the cruise ship outside of Japan. So, yep.
Mm. So do we think that the mutations of the virus... Do mutations to viruses, is it similar to the mutations in like DNA and cells?
Sure. I mean, viruses undergo the same type of replication, and the replication is what typically introduces those mutations into the various genomes. The difference with viruses is that, you know, they probably accrue more mutations more rapidly than like human cells would or animal cells. We have a lot of extensive machinery in our cells that's trying to repair DNA. And the enzyme that we have that copies our DNA has a very high fidelity, so it doesn't make mistakes very often. And again, viruses are very different from one another, and some of those viruses, their enzymes will have some of that same sort of proofreading capacity, but many of the viruses' enzymes that make copies of the viral templates or genomes, they don't have that proofreading ability. And so those viruses can accrue mutations very, very quickly in comparison. So, yeah.
And also the sheer number of viruses is crazy.
Yeah,
and essentially, do you think because it's simpler, things would run more simply? But then again, you're dealing with vast amounts of numbers.
Yeah, and again, it can be very simple. I think the simplest virus is probably one of those bacteriophage, and it probably only has about 4 or 5 proteins, 4 or 5 genes. Some of the small RNA viruses only have 7 genes, you know, so like the coronaviruses, that's a family of viruses that infect humans. They have very simple genes, genomes. The coronavirus, like I said, is the most complex RNA virus that infects humans, and it has, what did we say, 13 genes, 14 proteins, 30,000 bases for its genome, so that's pretty complex. But some of the DNA viruses, like herpes virus, chickenpox virus, those are really large viruses, and they can encode 100 proteins easily. So, yeah. So viruses are very different. Depends on which ones you're talking about.
What I find amazing is that, forget just like cells, but viruses, this mRNA goes into a cell, it produces some proteins, and I guess it also tells the ribosomes to produce some mRNA as well, and then it all just magically fits together into this complete unit, like with, you know.
I love the way you say magically fits together. Yeah. It's pretty amazing how different viruses will have different mechanisms for recognizing viral sequences or viral genomes. And so in the case of many of the RNA viruses, when they're copying themselves, they have proteins that tightly associate with the viral genetic material. And so they're called nucleocapsids because the nucleoproteins are actually in tight association with the genetic material. And so when you pull that material out, the genetic material, you usually pull out with that a lot of the nucleoproteins because they've got themselves wrapped around the genetic material. And so the genetic material is covered by these viral proteins. And so then different signals will pick up the viral proteins and make sure that those things get packaged together. But it's not 100% efficient, right? So in the case of many viruses, you'll get incomplete viral genomes packaged. So you'll get virus-like particles, but they won't have a complete genome, and so they won't be infectious. Or you'll have ones that are viable and complete, or you'll have ones that have extra copies of some of the genetic bits, and you'll have some that'll even package some cellular proteins or some cellular genetic information, sort of, okay, you're in the area, we're packaging all the stuff that we need to make more viruses, and we just happen to pick you up at the same time, and so you're going along for the ride in the next infectious cycle. So it's not, what should I say? It's not a fail-proof system in the sense that you always get perfect only virus-containing particles out. You sometimes get ones that don't work, you sometimes get ones that have more information than they need, and you sometimes get ones that have some cellular stowaways. So, yeah.
So this detailed analysis of what's going on, how did we actually discover this and work this all out? I mean, obviously we can't put an electron microscope there and do a super slow motion because everything occurs so quickly. Or maybe it doesn't occur so quickly, I'm not sure, but
are you talking about the case of China or in general?
No, I'm talking about how did we figure out that the replication process of viruses and the various things that tell the viruses to come together. How did we work that out?
Through hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands of experiments in hundreds of different laboratories over decades of research. I'm not exaggerating, right? So, I mean, these things, we don't just go into the lab one day and, you know, 2 weeks later, we've got it all figured out. We have to be able to identify that it's a virus and not some other organism that's causing the disease. And one of the ways that we do that is through microfiltration. So viruses tend to be much, much smaller than bacteria. And on the whole, that's absolutely true. And so if you have a filter that has very, very, very small holes, you're basically filtering out everything except viruses. Sometimes you get toxins, but the thing about toxins is toxins won't sort of reproduce if you serially dilute them and let them sort of spend some time on viable cells. So So there are ways to distinguish toxins from viruses, viruses from bacteria. Once you know you have a virus, then you try to grow it in cells. We have techniques for separating out cellular proteins and cellular debris from viruses. And then once you get a hold of a virus particle, you can do different types of analyses to determine if you have an RNA virus or a DNA virus. You can sequence the genomes pretty easily now. If you have an idea of any of the sequence that's in your virus, you have different ways of being able to pick up some of those sequences through using random sequences to try and amplify it. Once you amplify certain sequences, you can add tags and sequence through and actually get specific sequence that's to that virus, even if it's a unique virus that you've never seen before. I mean, I could go on and on. This would take, you know, multiple hours to describe all the ways that we find out how different viruses are either DNA or negative stranded or positive stranded RNA or segmented or non-segmented genomes. And then as to like their reproduction strategies and the replication of their proteins and their packaging strategies, again, for each different kind of virus, those studies have been done independently. And for some viruses, that data is not yet known because those studies haven't been done yet. So,
and then I guess you've got all the physics laboratories that can do like, mass spectrox cross-propy to check to see what kind of atoms or molecules are part of.
Yeah, you can see what you can actually read like the protein sequences and see what's going on there for sure. Yeah. And that's how you can tell if different. So some virus genomes actually need proteins associated with them in order to trigger replication or transcription. And so, you know, we learn those things through those types of analyses and techniques. Yeah.
So as coming from a software side, I have a very deep respect for biologists because as a programmer, we have like the luxury of being able to like debug code to stop all execution and step by step, you know, take our time to understand what's happening. And if we don't if we don't have those tools, then it can be quite frustrating. I mean, we can work around it, but you guys, it's like you're dealing with things that are like happening at lightning speed and they're so tiny and it takes months and months of research to do it. It's just like, I just want to tell my listeners how much respect I have for biologists.
Well, that's really nice of you to say that. We have some basic strategies. If we learn the basic strategies, then we also can strategize sort of how to intervene. And so, because most viruses hijack cellular machinery to make more viruses, that's a two-edged sword. We know how the cellular machinery works, or at least how a whole lot of it works today. But the tricky bit becomes, because the virus is using the cellular machinery, how do we target the virus without interfering with good, healthy cells? And so, you know, there are various techniques for doing that. But there's actually a drug that is showing that it's able to inhibit viral replication for these coronaviruses. Not quite sure about the data for the current one, but for MERS, there's been a recent study, and I just recently posted it to my social media page, that there's this drug that's available. And if you pre-treat with the drug before infection, or if you treat with the drug within 12 hours of infection in a monkey model, you basically are preventing disease. You don't prevent infection, but you limit the amount of infection so much that disease is prevented. So we have some tools in our box to be able to say, hey, we might be able to stop this one. I actually worked on some vaccine vectors, those things that carry the proteins of the virus that you're trying to protect against into a healthy individual to allow the immune system to make antibodies that attack that protein that will attack that protein when it sees the real virus. Actually worked on the vector that was actually used by the Canadians to make the Ebola vaccine as well. So wow. we have some tools in our toolbox that are pretty exciting for trying to intervene in the virus strategy of replication. But
you personally worked on that?
I personally worked on the vector. So I worked for this guy named Jack Rose, who developed the vector. It's called VSV, vesicular stomatitis virus, because that's the vector was originally identified as a virus that infected cattle. And we basically took that RNA virus, which is very, very simple in comparison to the SARS virus or the COV-219 virus that's infecting people in China now. We took that virus and we took out one of its own genes, and we put in other genes for other viruses, and then used that as an immunogen. So we gave it to animals, and we said, does this create disease? We got it to the point where the answer to that was no. Does it produce protective antibodies? The answer to that question was yes. And so we basically proved the concept that that vector could be used as a potential vaccine. So some folks in Canada said, we'd like to put the Ebola glycoprotein into that vector to see if we can use it as an Ebola vaccine. And Jack and I can remember sitting down and having a conversation with him and saying, do we want to do this here in-house, or do we want to send it out to them? Well, we only worked in a biosafety level 2 laboratory, and we decided that the risks were way too high to take a vector like VSV, which would infect almost every cell that you would introduce it to. We thought it was way too risky to take that backbone and put the Ebola virus glycoprotein into it. And so we decided, we don't want to do this. Let's give it to these folks in Canada. And we did, and they did, and that's actually what's being used as the Ebola vaccine right now. So
were they
pretty
using
amazing
level,
stuff.
Were they using a level 4 laboratory or 3?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Almost certainly level 4. I can't imagine that they might have developed it in level 3, but they would have had to have tested it in level 4.
And that's top yeah. level, yeah?
It is top level, yep. That's like the full suits with the, oxygen hoses and everything. So when I worked on SARS at the NIH back in 2003 to 2006, I actually worked on that virus for 3 years. We had to work with it under BSL-3 conditions. And so BSL-3 are sort of the Tyvek suits, the white suits, and then you have the little contraption that's strapped around you that has a hose that goes up and filters your air. So it's basically HEPA-filtered air, but you don't have to have like an independent air supply. It just filters the air that you're breathing. Yeah,
the only laboratory I ever worked in was a neuroscience laboratory, and basically you had a door
super
that you pressed.
Clean.
No, it wasn't. It was basically a number pad, and then you were like, you're supposed to wear like a white gown, and that was it. We didn't have any. Yeah, it,
oh,
was,
okay.
it was basically a neuroscience laboratory that were looking at toxins and, I think they were testing for like snake venom. Vaccines and just drugs
nice.
For like drugs for neuroscience purposes.
Nice, yeah.
I only spent 2 months in there, but it was quite a hard work because like it takes you so long to get your experiments all set up. Like you go in there for about an hour, then you start working. Some of the guys there, they spend like 3 or 4 hours getting their experiments ready, and then if they make a mistake anywhere along there, they basically go home because like there's nothing to do. I don't know what it's like, but when you were doing your work on your viruses, if the preparation time's that long.
Yeah, sometimes we would be in BSL-3 for most of the morning or most of the afternoon. Sometimes we would be in BSL-3 for the whole day, but usually if we were in BSL-3 for the whole day, we would take a break for lunch. Come out on suit, and have lunch, a bit of a break, and go back in. But a lot of the analysis that we had to do, and we did a lot of animal work. We developed several different animal models, including old mice and hamsters. And in the influenza side of the lab would work in ferrets. And then sometimes we would work in collaboration with primate facilities so that they could test the different constructs in primates. But we could be in BSL-3 for a whole day. I have to tell you, it was a very long day if you spent the whole day in BSL-3 because you'd come out and you'd be just exhausted. And it's not that you were working that much harder than if you'd been doing those same types of experiments just on a lab bench under BSL-2 conditions. But I think there's a subconscious amount of, stress associated with being breathing through the HEPA filters. And that's the other thing. That would be a limiting factor. We'd sometimes have to switch out HEPA filters because they're run on batteries. And so you have to charge the batteries overnight. And if we were in there and we hadn't fully charged our HEPA filters, we'd have to come out and replace the HEPA filter and go back in to have a fully charged battery. But yeah, challenging work.
Yeah, that's my thing. Like, those kind of filters are the only thing that's going to really protect you from viruses going around like today. Like, what kind of advice can you give to the general public? I mean, you see all these people like myself, even myself, buying like medical masks, but they're not going to really protect you from this stuff.
Well, you know, the medical mask might do a really good job of helping to protect you from influenza, which is spreading pretty efficiently this year. At least it is here in the U.S. I don't know what it's like in the U.K. That's where you are, right?
Yeah.
You're in the U.K.? Yeah.
Most of the
time. In the U.S. right now, we've got, you know, a pretty healthy flu, and I use that word, you know, ironically, a pretty healthy flu season going on right now. There are a lot of people getting sick. There's quite a few people dying. Many more have been infected. I think the last numbers I saw for this flu season alone, we have over 100,000 infections, hospitalizations, and we have, I hate to guess, it's in my most recent blog, but we have certainly more than 1,000 deaths associated with flu this year in the U.S. I think it's closer to 7,000, but again, I'd fact-check that before you spread that number around. Well, that's quite a few deaths, but the reality is that's not many more than is typical for a typical flu season. It's just on the high end of a typical flu season. And so that mask, you know, everybody running around with masks on, it's like, well, you may be preventing some spread of the flu, but because we don't really know how the coronavirus is spreading from person to person in China, and we don't know how it was introduced into the human population, and based on past work with SARS coronavirus, I would say that mask is doing very little to prevent the spread of a coronavirus. So, but if it makes you feel better, you're less stressed, and if you're less stressed, your immune system is functioning better. So we'll go with that too.
Yeah. So I guess we don't know anything about the longevity of this virus or even viruses in general on, say, a hard surface or in water.
We know some. Yeah, for sure we know some of that information. Those studies have been done on viruses that we've had a handle on for a while, and that was one of the most shocking and surprising bits of information that I encountered when I was working on SARS. So with viruses, because viruses aren't alive, you can't technically say, well, the virus is alive outside of a host or a cell, but you can say it's viable. And what that means is if you were to take that virus and leave it in the environment for a while and then come back and somehow collect it and reintroduce it into a living cell, can it still infect the cell? And for how long can it be outside of a cell on a hard surface or a dried surface and still maintain viability? Well, before the SARS outbreak in 2003, the virus that had the longest viability that I'm aware of outside of a living cell was the polio virus. And the polio virus could survive outside a living cell for about 72 hours.
Oh, that's not that long at all.
That's not that long at all. But what we found with SARS is that SARS, after 1 week outside a living cell, had only lost one log of infectivity. So if you started with 100,000 particles of SARS, after 1 week, you still had 10,000 particles that could infect.
Right.
And
Do they know what the decay methods are? Is it the air reacting with the protein?
Yeah, so for SARS, no. I would say for most, no. We don't know that. And so this is a little bit of interesting information for the nerds out there. Probably too much information for other people.
Only the nerds are left.
Okay, good. So you know, when I was describing viruses earlier, I said they had like a genome, genetic information that was covered by protein. And then some viruses, that's their basic structure. They have just genetic information that's surrounded by protein. So for poliovirus is RNA virus surrounded by proteins, and that's it. You've got this protein capsid that has the genetic information, and as soon as it hits a cell that it can infect, it gets in and it immediately starts producing protein for the virus. And so we always thought, prior to SARS, that those types of viruses were the hardiest virus outside of the living cell. Because the other type of basic viral structure is that you have the genetic information surrounded by protein, surrounded by a lipid envelope. So the things that sort of make up cellular membranes, right? And so those lipid envelopes on the outside are derived from different cell membranes, most of the time the plasma membrane, but sometimes the nuclear membrane. But those viruses are always thought to be less hardy, because if they lose the integrity of the lipid membrane, you think that the virus is no longer infectious. Right. Well, SARS has an envelope. It has a lipid membrane around a protein core that surrounds its genetic information. And yet SARS was at least, you know, at least 10 times more longer viability outside a host than polio. And so we're kind of left scratching our heads. No one really knew the answer as to why it was so viable, at least not the last time I checked the research, which is, I admit, it's been a while since I've checked that particular fact, whether anybody's done any further experimentation on that. But yeah, sort of very counterintuitive. Like, why was SARS able to survive that long outside a host? Best minds didn't know. So
this SARS virus somehow was, it lost its lipid layer and it was just like lying on the surface of some electron microscope somewhere? Or?
Well, no, but you would think, no. So they actually did the experiments where they would coat the virus on a countertop, you know, or on a hard non-porous surface. And then they would come back at different time points and they would rehydrate it and collect it and then take that collection and put it onto viable cells. And so you would imagine that after a week on a non-porous hard surface, that lipid membrane would be totally desiccated, that it would be dried out, right? Yeah. That it would no longer be intact. And yet the virus maintained infectivity, which, you know, as far as I know, no one has ever done like EM studies as to what those rehydrated viruses looked like before they tried to reintroduce them back into cells. But based on what I know of the viral biology, I would say that somehow the spike glycoprotein, which, the reason they're called coronaviruses, this is kind of interesting. The reason they're called coronaviruses is because when you look at them under an electron microscope, the surface has these globular spikes that come out of the membrane. And those globular spikes in the membrane viewed under an electron microscope looks like a crown. Or, you know, so hence the word corona, meaning crown. Yeah. That's where they got their name. So if that membrane is desiccated, dried, and no longer holding its own integrity, then somehow those spike globular proteins must still be associated with the nucleocapsid and the genetic information in a way that it's able to attach to the cellular receptor and be internalized into the endosomes and infect the cells. So somehow it must maintain enough structural integrity even with the loss of the envelope to remain infectious. So
and do we know if it's airborne or not?
We don't know if it's airborne. In the case of the current outbreak, we don't know if it's airborne. We know for SARS that it could be spread through aerosolized droplets, but that it didn't have to be spread through the air. Yeah, so when a droplet that contains virus hits a hard surface and it dries on that hard surface, it's called a fomite. And so fomites can be infectious for some viruses, and SARS can be spread that way. SARS in the original outbreak was actually spread through people walking into an elevator where other people had been in an elevator and touched, like, the elevator rails or the buttons in the elevator. Some of the SARS had actually been spread from hospital refrigerators where they'd stored samples, where somebody would come along and open the refrigerator after somebody had stored an infectious sample, and just by touching the refrigerator, they were able to incur the infection. And so SARS could be spread through the touching of a contaminated hard surface. And so can this one? Well, probably. I mean, it's spreading more efficiently than SARS did. But again, we don't know if it's spreading more efficiently human to human or through hard surfaces, or if it's still constantly being reintroduced into the human population from an unknown environmental source, right? We just don't know that bit of information yet because we don't know what the environmental source is.
Mm-hmm. So if we wanted to test for airborne, couldn't we just do that if we had some of the virus and we had some kind of test device to to float the virus and then see if it floats, it's airborne, right?
Sure. So, I mean, so I guess to answer the question is, it's probably, you can probably aerosolize it. You can aerosolize a lot of viruses, but that, in order for it to be spread through the air, it means that if I'm an infected individual, that when I, let's say, when I cough or when I sneeze, the virus has to be present in a cell-free environment in my respiratory tract in order for it to be expelled, right?
Right.
And we don't know the course of the viral infection inside a human body. So is it present in those secretions, and can it be aerosolized from an infected person through coughing and sneezing? We don't know. But, yeah. I mean, common sense tells us that yes, probably, but you know, maybe it's in my saliva, or it's in my sweat, or it's in other secretions. Mm-hmm. And those secretions are in intimate contact. I'm in intimate contact with my own secretions. And when I touch another surface, I'm actually laying virus down if I'm infected.
Yeah,
so we don't know if it's like, so I wipe my mouth, I lay it on a surface. You touch the surface, you wipe your mouth. That's not airborne, right?
Yeah,
So, yeah.
Airborne, I guess, is like if you sneeze and the thing ends up like a mile away.
Yeah, and you're walking by and you take a deep breath, unlucky you, right?
Is there anything that exists like that in the world?
Well, flu's airborne. Measles is airborne.
Okay.
That's why measles is so stinking infectious. Sorry. Measles is crazy infectious. Measles is one of the most infectious viruses we know.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So, well, I'm really impressed with your answers. I've gone off way off the questions that I gave you, haven't I?
Like I told you, I love to talk about viruses, so you better reel me back in if you want to get some specific ones answered.
I always thought bacteriophages looked kind of cool. I guess so. Coronavirus it attaches to probably other proteins, channels on the phospholipid layer versus, well, I guess they both bacteriophages and coronavirus.
Yeah. So coronaviruses, at least in the case of SARS, and I think it's also true for MERS, don't know about the new one yet, but in the case of SARS, the cellular receptor is something called ACE2. I won't bore you with what the ACE stands for. But it's basically a cellular protein that's used to help regulate sort of blood pressure and the contraction of blood vessels. And so you find it on like cardiac epithelial cells. You find it in kidney cells. Obviously, there has to be enough of it somewhere in the lungs for it to become infectious in the respiratory tract. But yeah, it's a you know, sort of normal physiologically functioning protein that the virus is using to get into side cells. So
why does the bacteriophage need these legs to latch onto it versus a coronavirus that doesn't need these legs?
So the coronavirus doesn't need the legs because they have the spikes, right?
Right.
So the spikes come in contact with the protein. That's the same for the flu. The flu has hemagglutinin and neuraminidase on the outside. They're these proteins that stick out of the outside of the flu virus. Those come in contact with a particular type of glycoprotein on cell surfaces that have a particular type of linkage for the sialic acid. And if the particular type of linkage for the sialic acid is right, then those proteins can attach to those glycoproteins, and that's how flu gets into cells. But in the case of bacteriophage, I don't know much about the cellular receptors in the bacteria, but you're right. A lot of the phage, not all of them, but a lot of the phage looks sort of like these lunar landing modules, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the feet of the modules land on the bacteria. And so there has to be some type of an affinity for those feet to the surface of the bacteria. But then it sort of does a squat, if you will.
Yeah.
And the head and the syringe part of the phage come and sit down on top of the bacteria, and then it gets the DNA gets or the RNA gets injected into the bacteria at a very high force, and so it's pretty interesting because these little phage are running around like preloaded syringes, and as soon as they hit the right bacterial surface, the syringe triggers and the and the genetic information is pumped into the cell. Pretty fascinating stuff.
Yeah, the bacteriophages are like the scary ones, things of nightmares. When you look at coronavirus, it doesn't look as scary as a bacteriophage. I guess they can both be deadly enough if given the correct genetic material.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about the bacteriophage, but coronavirus, sometimes, yeah, we have to worry about that. You know, so I gotta tell you this statistic, right? Sorry, or this number, but just because I find the number fascinating. So used to be we only discovered viruses because of the diseases that were associated with the viruses. We'd basically see a sick plant, sick dog, sick human, and we'd go in and we'd say, what's making the plant, dog, human sick? And we discover viruses. Well, now we have the ability to go into an environmental sample, take any environmental sample, a sugar cube's worth of dirt, a sugar cube's worth of lake water or seawater, and ask what's in that, you know, as far as genetic information is concerned. What genetic information is in this? And what we've discovered is that in a cube of dirt or in a cube of lake water or seawater, there's over a million virus particles.
In a cube of seawater?
In a cube of seawater, in a cube of dirt. There's over a million virus particles.
How big is a cube?
You know, like a sugar cube.
A sugar cube.
Like, you know how... Yeah, well, you actually, in the UK, your sugar cubes are much bigger than ours. So a cubic centimeter.
Of genetic seawater.
A cubic centimeter of water from the sea, from the ocean. A cubic centimeter of dirt from out in your yard. You take that into a laboratory and you say, what's in here? And you're going to find out that there's about 100,000 bacteria and about a million virus particles.
That's insanely
high. And those virus particles, for the most part, are viruses that infect bacteria. And so what that tells us is that, number one, if you were to be able to like detect how many viruses are there on planet Earth, that number is so big you can't even begin to wrap your head around it, or I can't wrap my head around it. It's a 1 followed by 31 zeros. That's how many virus particles there are on planet Earth. A 1 followed by 31 zeros. Mm-hmm. So if we could collect all those and stack the viruses end to end, that stack of viruses would go to the Andromeda Galaxy and back 20 times.
Say that again. Say that again.
If we can stack those viruses on top of one another, the stack of viruses would reach from Earth's surface to the Andromeda Galaxy and back again 20 times. And the Andromeda Galaxy is 2.5 million light years away.
Are you talking about the viruses as they are, or the viruses stretched out like?
The viruses as they are, like compact in their little viral bodies. And their little compact viral bodies, if we stacked them end to end, they would reach to the Andromeda Galaxy and back 20 times.
That's quite astonishing, yeah.
It is quite astonishing. If you could weigh them all, they'd weigh the equivalent of about 75 million blue whales.
75 million blue whales?
Yeah. Just let those numbers kind of sink in a little bit. And the reality is the vast majority of those viruses aren't doing anything harmful. In fact, they're actually keeping the bacteria on planet Earth in check so that you and I can live a healthy, happy life.
Would you say that the biomass is the greatest percentages of the Earth biomass is viruses?
Yes.
And then probably
biomass, because they're pretty small little suckers, right? Biomass is, the vast majority is going to be prokaryotic cells. But right. by the numbers, viruses are going to outnumber prokaryotic cells by a factor of 10 to 15. By the numbers, yeah.
So what do you do when you're not working on research?
So when I'm not thinking about viruses, well, you know, I work with this organization called Reasons to Believe. And so here at Reasons to Believe, we think that recent scientific discoveries reinforce a biblical view of the Creator God that we come to know personally through the person of Jesus Christ. So you know, even like what I just had to say about viruses and bacteria and how viruses are keeping bacteria in check, it's, to me, I look at that and I think, look, Earth is finely tuned at the most fundamental level of life for bacteria to be doing what they need to do to provide nutrients for us, but they're being kept in check by something that can't replicate it on its own. So those viruses are keeping the bacterial population in check, which that bacterial population is critical for us, but it has to be kept in check, because if it wasn't, Earth would be one giant ball of bacteria because they're masters of reproduction and adaptation, and they would basically sequester every nutrient and compound that could be sequestered, and there'd be no room for other organisms like plants or animals or humans. So even at the most fundamental level of life, it's finely tuned for our thriving. So
did you find faith through your studies or before you were like a scientist?
You know, I did not find faith through my studies. I fell in love with science really early on, probably about 4 or 5 years old, because of the original Star Trek series. But then when I was 12, I was a little bit of a hooligan. I kind of broke rules just because I could get away with it. I think sometimes I was a little too...
I was really good at that as well at school.
I think I was just a little too clever and just didn't understand what the rules were all about. And sometimes I still don't. But, you know, somebody invited me to church, and it was through a bunch of music and the testimony of one of the band members talking about how they'd encountered the risen Christ and had a personal relationship with him and found reconciliation to God and forgiveness for their sins and hope for the future. It's like, boy, everything that I had sort of picked up on pieces in Sunday school and some things that I'd never heard before in my life just kind of came together, coalesced, and it's like all of a sudden I realized, wow, God is real, Jesus is real, and it really matters that Easter happened because it means he's alive, he's not dead, he's really God, and I can have a relationship with him. And so all of that sort of happened in my 12-year-old brain and heart and spirit, and I've been trying to follow God since I was 12, and he's been faithfully holding on to me in the meantime. So
one question that somebody asked me once, I was graduating, I was a software developer, and he was like, how can you be like a scientist programmer but still believe in God? Why didn't people ask that question?
Why do people ask that question?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I didn't have anybody ask me that question until I was in grad school. And it was actually one of my fellow classmates from China that asked me that question. They're like, how can you be a Christian and be serious about your science? But it's like, you know, the Christian worldview, this idea that the universe is ordered in such a way that we can explore it and it's reliable and we can actually learn things that we can implement to care for creation and to care for ourselves and one another. I mean, all of that makes extreme sense in this larger narrative that there's a God behind it that cares about us. It makes much more sense to me in that bigger narrative than in this narrative that somehow all of this happened just through physical interactions that weren't really guided by anything and just happened to be this way. I mean, that's a pretty big stretch. So I find this other one much more credible, especially when you start to throw in my own personal experience of the living God. So,
I mean, you'd have to think from a designer, from looking on the outside into a design, you would notice if there's a designer behind it. And having my experience as a software developer, and like programs don't just evolve, you know, you have to sit and be very, very guided behind these pretty complicated programs for some of the biggest companies in the world that I work for. And then biology, you look at biology and like we can't produce anything that can self-replicate yet. I mean, even a virus can reproduce itself with just taking chemicals out of thin air. We don't have anything that can self-replicate. At least I don't have top secret clearance, so maybe I'm wrong here, but
we have very small RNA molecules that can self-replicate, but they don't come close enough to being able to harbor the type of information that you'd need. So it's really, a lot of people are going to think this sounds like a very ignorant statement, but I challenge them to go out and research it. You know, we only know life comes from life. Mm-hmm. And even the simplest cell that we know, there's still at least one third of the proteins required for that cell to make another cell just like it that we have no idea what those proteins are doing. So when we think we've got a handle on what's involved for like origin of life, for life from non-life, we're not even close. And even if I could tell you all the components you needed and give them to you in the proper ratios, completely purified from all contaminants, I could give you everything that you need, if I knew everything that you need for the simplest cell, and you would still not be able to reconstruct it into a living organism. So you just, because it requires being structured in the right way with systems and subsystems that are dependent upon each other and that are timed and orchestrated in regard to one another. So it's not just having the components. If we had all of the components and put them all together, we wouldn't be able to put them together in the right way. We wouldn't be able to synchronize them in the right chronological interdependence that's necessary for a living organism to continue to reproduce. And so it's a real challenge, but I don't mind making the statement because I think I'm on very solid ground. Life only comes from life, and almost always from like kind of life. Now, in the case of, can we go into the lab and manipulate different things and come out with something that's alive? Yes, but we're a living organism that's using living organisms to manipulate living organisms in order to produce living organisms. So even that's a bit of a, it has a lot of confounding factors. So anyway, cool. I've really enjoyed our time.
Yeah,
thanks
it's been
so
really
much.
Good. You're about 61 minutes now. So.
Yeah.
Cool. So if people want to reach out to you, how do they go about finding you on the web?
Sure, they can find me. They can find me on social media. RTBAJ, official, something like that. I should know my own Facebook handle, shouldn't I? Anyway, I'm AJ with RTB, and I'm also on Twitter. And they can also find me on the RTB website, Reasons to Believe website. That's reasons.org. I have a blog called Theorems and Theology, because I like to talk about the science and God. And so at the interface of those two, Theorems and Theology at reasons.org, or they can find me on Facebook or Twitter.
Fantastic. Well, it was a real honor to have you on the show, and AJ, and a real world expert in virology, biology helped contribute to the medical assistance from victims of the Ebola virus, which is like top level research and clinical biology there. So yeah, so that's it. I will probably have to listen to this episode a few more times myself to remember and understand everything, but it's certainly a
no worries, mate.
Fascinating level conversation, and thank you, mate. Anyone who's managed to keep up to date with this conversation, and we'll have many more scientists on this podcast. Certainly, I'm speechless. Good job.
Yeah, thanks so much. Maybe you can have me back again someday, and we can talk about CRISPR gene editing or something like that.
1,000%. Yeah. My statistics lecturer will be very angry for saying 1,000%. But yeah.
Okay, sweet.
All
sweet.
Right.
Hey, God bless. Take care.
Thank you. God bless. And yeah. Thank you, my listener. See you again shortly. Bye-bye.